Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast,
hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Stahmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
Normally, Jörg Meyer-Stahmer is making this LED podcast, and today we invert the rules, and Frank Weltring and myself, Ulrich Hammes Liedtke, we are interviewing Jörg about his experience in development work and especially in local economic development. The background of this podcast is a book which a bunch of colleagues and friends of Jörg wrote, Milestones in a Process of Innovation, Change and Development, and it was a birthday anthology. Within the introduction chapter, Frank and I suggested to make a podcast and record some questions we had in regard your professional career and your thinking about development. And well, now here we are. Hello, Jörg.
Hi there.
Hello, Frank.
Hello.
We are looking back to a career of 20 years working in development. And what was driving force? What motivated you after studying political science or during your studies to look for a professional career in the development field? Was it a rational decision or was it more by accident?
It was actually pure coincidence. It had a lot to do with the fact that at university, I quite accidentally came across this topic of development studies. The starting point was that at Hamburg University, where I did my master's in political science, one of the main focus areas was peace research and conflict research. And we had a working group there in those days where we looked at causes of conflicts, trying to research the causes of societal conflicts, of armed conflict. And we did a couple of case studies there. And one of the case studies where I was involved was on the Afghanistan conflict, which in those days was already quite active. It was those days when the Soviet Union was still blundering around in Afghanistan. And we dug really deep and we tried really to understand what was the underlying reasons for that conflict. And ultimately then I came up with a very interesting theory, and I was quite disappointed when then a couple of weeks later I figured out that somebody else had come up with that same theory 30 years before me. But that was basically how I got introduced to handbooks on development studies and how I got to start reading more systematically on development research. The other thing that happened in those days was that I started to develop an interest in new technology. So the early 80s, so that was just before 1984, which was the famous Orwell year, and everybody thought, okay, now we get the computers and there's 1984 and what's happening now and what kind of disaster is expecting us there. So I started to get to develop an interest in what was happening with new media technologies, new broadcasting technologies, microelectronics, and all those things. And there was some academic discussion, very speculative academic discussion going on in those days that I found to some extent convincing and in many respects rather superficial. And I dug deeper into that, and I found that very stimulating. And of course, there was a huge opportunity there, because in those days in Germany, there were exactly, as far as I knew, there were exactly two people who were in any way systematically working on that point. One was a very experienced researcher, a very prestigious researcher, and it was me. So I could start to publish articles on all sorts of issues, new media in developing countries, microelectronics in developing countries, microelectronics and international division of labor, how is radical technical change going to influence the international hierarchy, what kind of windows of opportunity are opening for latecomer countries. Because that was the other thing that was happening in those days. There had been dependency theory in the 60s and 70s, which basically said latecomer development is impossible. And with a position like that, any single case of latecomer development falsifies the theory. And at that stage, we had four such cases: South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong. So the theory was obviously questionable. And what we tried to understand was, what is happening there? What is going on there? How is it possible that countries that in principle, as we tended to assume and as we were taught at university, can never develop, can never catch up. How is it possible that such companies are going through rapid growth processes and are catching up really, really fast and moving towards the leading edge in terms of certain high technology sectors?
Often, if somebody looks back how some ideas started or some processes started in their lives, sometimes it's related to persons which you got to know on the way and which somehow guide you or maybe give you new ideas. You just said in this case it was very much related to coincidence, but could you also say that there were some persons who supported you in this aspect or who gave you ideas to move into this field of innovation and technology?
Well, I think when I moved into that, that was pretty much driven by my own curiosity. The very important person, or actually two persons I would have to mention is this, the guy who then basically recruited me for German Development Institute in 1988, Klaus Esser, who was the head of the Latin American Department and the Industrialization Department in those days. So he wanted to have somebody in his department who was looking at technology and innovation. And there weren't so many. That was the nice coincidence. I mean, I was utterly surprised when he approached me, and I was flattered and terribly nervous, because I found the idea of working in a prestigious organization like that one absolutely overwhelming. So Klaus Esser definitely was the one person who then pushed me into this field and was very much encouraging me to also continue working and to broaden my perspective at the topic. And the other one was Wolfgang Hillebrand, one of the colleagues at that department at German Development Institute, who had been doing a lot of research on Korea and other newly industrializing countries, and who was kind of a mentor in many respects, and a person from whom I learned a lot of things in those early days of my career.
You talked about the dependency theory when you talked about the latecomer theory in development studies. What was the setting in the community? What were the mainstreams? And afterwards, when you developed this with the ESSA team, the systemic competitiveness approach, how you related it to business research like Michael Porter? Wasn't it very difficult or different to the mainstream thinking in development study to link with business university like Harvard is in thinking from another continent and from a different mindset when you develop this approach?
Well, I'm not so sure, and I think that takes us back to the motivation that I had to stay in this field. What I found always fascinating in the development field is that it tends to be intrinsically multidisciplinary and to some extent interdisciplinary. What I always found not so attractive was to be extremely specialized in just one discipline. Because I always had this feeling that so many different disciplines had very important ideas and very important insights to offer. And in development studies, you could actually cater for that. I could delve into so many different topics as long as they were remotely relevant to what I was supposed to do. Right. So I mean, there was a stage when I was a subscriber at the same time of Business Week and of rather leftist development journals. And I found them, both of them, to be most insightful. The other thing that probably has to do with my personality traits is that I'm usually uncomfortable with established wisdom. Whenever there's a set of established wisdom that everybody accepts, I'm wondering, and I find it not necessarily plausible, then I'm wondering, okay, so maybe is this really true, and maybe is there another truth that we also could uncover, right? So looking back at the early days of the criticism of dependency theory, there was a German researcher, I think he still lives actually, Dieter Senghas, who had been the German pioneer in dependency research, and then in 1982 he came out with a book which had the title Learning from Europe, where to some extent he actually trashed dependency theory. That was something that really resonated with me, and that very much influenced my thinking.
Jörg, it was very interesting when we prepared the book and the introduction. We had to look through all your literature and all your papers again. So it's always a good chance also to write an introduction to really get to know your track of papers and publications which you have done. what was very interesting for ourselves was the mixture of literature which was related to European Union countries, especially on Germany, on innovation and technology. And on the other hand, literature which was from the beginning onwards very much also related towards developing countries. And you just said you never specialized, and I think that makes you also so special in that sense, that you are somehow knowledgeable in different areas and different continents. So how did it come that you managed to not be only a development expert, but also taking track on the development in countries like Germany or within the European Union?
Mm. Well, I think it had a lot to do with the kind of culture that we had in that department at German Development Institute, where somebody like Wolfgang Hillebrand, for instance, was spending a lot of his time looking out for the next OECD study to come out, and then going through that very thoroughly and sharing his main insights on that with us. So it was, there was a habit to say, look, we cannot be specialists in certain areas, such as specializing in Latin America and East Asia only. Because when we travel to those countries, when we interact with people in those places, they want to know what is it like in Germany? What is it like in Europe? What is your experience with competitiveness? What is your experience with promotion of innovation?
Yes.
So there always was this insight that we had to be knowledgeable on that. And I had a very practical attitude in that respect, and that was that the most effective way of learning about a given topic was to write a paper about it. Because that forced me to go through the literature and to digest it and understand it, to be able to write a paper that was reasonably sensible.
Crucial concept in your career is this concept of systemic competitiveness. And you had one of your fellows at the Institute was Dirk Messner, and he wrote also an article looking back to your experience, and we published at the beginning, therefore, also this article. Looking back to this experience, this publication of systemic competitiveness, now, is it still worth to use this concept? You have to modify the thinking, or it confirms a new time, also with a new crisis we are in, financial crisis, confirms the hypothesis of this research?
Actually, I think it does. And I mean, as you know, I am still working on that and trying to take it further. And actually taking it to the next level. I think the it's important to point out the context where that that approach came from. What we were facing in those days was a discussion where, on the one hand, we had people who said, well, all this state intervention is just wrong. What we need is structural adjustment. We need to get the macroeconomic framework conditions straight. And once that has happened, then development will happen. And on the other hand, there were rather traditional thinkers around industrial policy and import substituting development and things like that, who were still defending infant industry and who were pointing at Korea and Taiwan, which were indeed very successful cases of infant industry protection and industrial policy and all that. And they said, well, what we just have to do is to figure out how we in other countries, like in Brazil or Argentina or Uruguay or whatever, how we can learn from it and can kind of replicate that experience. And what we said was basically, well, this kind of antagonism, this just doesn't make much sense, because those structural adjustment people, they simply ignore the fact that there hasn't been any country that has gone through latecomer development without a very active role of the state. Because latecomer development simply doesn't happen on its own. It has to be actively promoted by society. And that typically means, to some extent, by government. And on the other hand, we were not so happy with the more traditionalist colleagues who were basically putting yesterday's arguments forward, not recognizing that the world was changing and that the political economy of import substitution in many countries, like in Argentina, where you live, Yuli, had created a situation where it was absolutely impossible for them to copy or to learn from Korea and Taiwan in any consistent way. So that was the starting point to think about systemic competitiveness and to take the discussion further, to say, well, it's not the one or the other extreme. Let's try to integrate that. Let us accept that macroeconomic framework conditions are crucial, and that if you cannot even control your currency, if you cannot even stabilize your currency, you're unlikely to be able to stabilize anything in your country, let alone shape any competitive advantage. While at the same time, if you then stabilize your macroeconomic framework conditions, there's still all sorts of active interventions that you need. I think that the downside of what we did in those days were two things. The one thing was that even though we called it systemic competitiveness, we didn't have a very convincing and consistent understanding of the concept of systems and systemic. We never really explored what systemic genuinely means. I mean, we related it to it in a more intuitive way, or we used to explain that it was systems as Friedrich List had been writing about systems in the 19th century. And that did make sense to some extent, but I think we wasted an opportunity there. We should have gone much deeper into that. And the other point, the other element of the downside was that in our discourse and our prescriptions, we were still quite optimistic in terms of what latecomer countries could achieve, and we still didn't fully realize how limited the governance capacity was in many of those countries.
Then the balance of this kind of countries, problem of lack of development is still there. Probably today it's much higher than in the time when you wrote the book on systemic competitiveness. Huh?
Yeah, and I mean, to some extent, some of the things that we intuitively knew in those days are accepted wisdom now. For instance, when we wrote that stuff, when we started writing that stuff in the early 90s, everybody was still assuming that a proliferation of natural resources was an asset. And now everybody knows that it's a curse. There's a resource curse, right? And for us, it was pretty obvious that many Latin American countries were suffering from the resource curse. And we always said, well, if there is a soft option, then it's rather unlikely that a society will decide to go the hard way. Societies go the hard way, like the Koreans did, because they have no alternative.
In some kind, the systemic competitiveness approach is also a middle way, you know, like you described it, between neoliberal approach and more state interventional approach, which both, especially the when we look into Latin America, the socialism of the 21st century, we have a certain roll back. Do you think that this kind of middle way give a real opportunity for less developed countries to emerge in the world economy, or you lost your hope you had in this time?
Well, I'm still pretty hopeful in principle. I'm not so hopeful for some Latin American countries, because the resource curse still rules, right? It's still, and in recent years it has been more relevant than ever before. I mean, the kind of resource boom we've seen in past years is unprecedented, really. So many of the countries still have a soft option, and I think there's little reason to expect that those countries will choose the hard option, the tough option. At the same time, what we're seeing is, I think, quite a few countries that don't really have a soft option, and who are starting to get organized, and who are starting to get their job together, and are embarking on very serious endogenous development and locally based or nationally based development efforts. I mean, whenever I'm interacting with people from Ghana, for instance, I'm really impressed. They are absolutely up to date as far as the preconditions and the necessities for development are concerned, and they appear to be quite willing to go for it.
Look, in the book, in the introduction, we try to differentiate the last 20 years of your research and work in the time where you worked for the German Development Institute and where you worked for the INEF, the Institute of Development and Peace in Duisburg. But I would like just to stay again with the German Development Institute time. Dirk Messer says in his publication that it was the systemic competitiveness approach was a path-breaking publication at that time, and you still see that this publication is important in a lot of development agencies, including the GTZ, the German Development Corporation. At least they call it the systemic competitiveness approach and what they understand under it. You and your research was very much impacted by this publication and the insights which you got from that, and you were the one from the authors who worked continuously with this systemic competitiveness approach. What would you say, what have you further developed in this approach? Because you did also a publication on the revisiting the systemic competitiveness.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I would like to point out is that I'm not so sure that anybody has ever applied the concept properly. And the first who is to blame for that is us at that group at GDI in those days, because we never took the effort to really develop it to the point where it was practically applicable. That was one of the missed opportunities that, for instance, Dirk and I have often talked about and often shared our frustration about. For instance, when you look at what is happening in GTZ, they are using the terms micro, meso, and macro a lot, but they're using that in the American sense, not in our sense. Mm. Right? Micro is the local level, meso is the regional level, macro is the national level. And if you do if a GTZ person does very specific sector-focused interventionist selective policy advice at a national level, they would still claim that they are macro. So that just tells you that. The key messages that we tried to make weren't properly understood, or were probably difficult to understand. And like I said, it was really pretty much our fault. What some people have been trying since, and what I have been busy with since, was to ask, well, how can we make this more practically relevant, and what can we do to both strengthen the foundation, the conceptual foundation, and make it more practically applicable for practitioners. And I think I'm not claiming that we are making any quick progress in that respect, but we are slowly getting there. From a conceptual angle, I think what is happening in complexity research is very interesting to what we are doing. And complexity, this whole new science around complexity, is a very important element that wasn't around in those days, that we weren't aware of, and that I've been reading about increasingly recently, and I found that fits very nicely with what we have been doing. For instance, I mean, one of the points that we at MesoPartner consistently make is that trying to do planning in a situation where most of the parameters are unknown and cannot be known, and where most of the consequences of your interventions are unpredictable, is maybe not such a good idea. And that is one of the arguments that those complexity people would very much make. Also, the way this complexity research is linked to practical things is through the discipline of change management and providing a conceptual foundation for change management, which again is something that we have been discussing for quite some time, and that we also did, I recall, at least one podcast about. So I think that is kind of defining the agenda in terms of how to solidify the foundation for systemic competitiveness. From a complexity perspective, also from a governance perspective, and at the same time making it practically operational, turning into something that can be used relatively easily by practitioners in the field.
Well, this is probably a good point to make a break. We talked about the academic motivation and foundation of the work of Jörg, and we will prepare another podcast on Jörg as a practitioner and the link between his academic work with his consultancy and facilitation activities.
We would also like to get to know a little bit more from Jörg's time in Duisburg, why he moved to MesoPartner, becoming a businessman. That would be of special interest also for us.
Yeah, and perhaps we mention now the book. It's published in a Jurgish way in the internet by Lulu, and you can download it. It's called Milestones in a Process of Innovation, Change and Development. And it's edited by MesoPartner with contribution by colleagues and friends of Dr. Jörg Meyer-Stahmer.
You can find this publication under www.lulu.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jörg.